So as we come to the end of the first volume of these Planetary Tantra Talks, I would like to leave you with these words to contemplate that are taken from The True Anarchy of Life on Earth. John writes as such, "The power of the authorities is a moral illusion, enforced as a lie, that is so transparent it needs the continuous application of brutal, murderous force to be sustained. This lie is the opposite of the truth. Only freedom to explore and express its natural tendencies will allow humanity to reach its true potential. This freedom is the true anarchy of the life on Earth. It is the basis of the confidence of the wisdom goddess Sophia, the foundation of her reliance on the species she designed." So with that in mind, and it might be slightly jumping the gun, so to speak, please enjoy this talk and the following one to come in a few days. Welcome to Planetary Tantra Talk number 15. It is September 1st in the year 2011. I'm sure everyone is excited to know if we are going to enter into a double shift of Bhairavi, or if we're going to be entering into Shodashi. So, John, I welcome you to the talk tonight, and can you relieve the anticipation there on that subject?
Absolutely not.
It's too early.
Yeah, I can't read it right now, and there's some wonderful omens in the air, actually. Bird omens, which we often see here in Andalusia, have been helpful, perhaps, in determining this. But I can't really say yet. But I'd like to return to that subject at the end of this interview, if you will remind me, Thomas.
Okay, I will do that. All right. Now, there's a couple of loose ends to cover up, and then you said that you want to kind of take the lead tonight, so that does fill me with a little bit of trepidation, because I never know where the Nawal is going to lead, but I will hang on as tightly as I can. And before we do that, let's go ahead and cover a couple things that we had left over from last time. One is the current surge. We're right at the end of the surge, the perigee surge. Do you want to go into where that was located and what the significance of that is?
Yeah, I would actually, but that's in my notes, Thomas, because can we pick it up about halfway through?
That, sure, absolutely.
I want to put it in continuity with some other things. The last surge we had was on Wednesday, Tuesday. It was in 6 degrees of Libra, which is in the upper, you could say the throat of the Virgin. And so that is the timing, that was the timing to send out the crop circle challenge. Mm-hmm. It went out on that surge. Hmm. But I have some more to say about that. I would like to put in later on. I have it in my notes here.
Okay, very good.
Okay.
I will. I look forward to that. Let's see. The other thing that was kind of left over on my mind was when you're talking about the lemniscate, and I looked that up on Wikipedia, and so I now have an idea of what that is, an infinity symbol, basically, and tipped over eight. And in conjunction with that, you were talking about the inner structure of the mothership, and you mentioned that, in connection with that, that it's a glass bottom, and I wasn't sure what you meant by that statement.
Well, glass bottom is kind of a metaphor, but you can also visualize it as a glass bottom. Remember that this is a steam sailor. She navigates by the propulsion of air and by steam. A limnus gate is a very elongated figure eight in which one loop is longer than the other, and the shorter loop is fatter than the longer loop.
Mm-hmm.
As that as a boat, you have a lowered front deck and a high rear deck, just like you had in the sailing boats of the Spanish galleons that came to the New World.
Mm-hmm.
The lower front deck, the long part of the limnus gate, has a deeply rounded hull and a glass bottom. The higher upper deck, which constitutes the rear part of the ship, does not have a glass bottom. It contains the ballast and the gyroscopes to balance the boat. So that's how you might visualize it. And at the juncture, at the waist, the narrow waist of the limnus gate is the narrowest part of the deck of the mother ship. It's the part where the lower deck joins to the upper deck. Sort of like the in a figure eight, in a hourglass, mm-hmm. the narrow part of the structure.
Mm-hmm.
And at that part of the deck is where the helm is located. That's where the steering wheel is located. And the barycenter Earth-Moon system, which is the steering wheel of the mother ship, is centered there, if you want to use that visualization. Hmm. And then the actual rudder of the ship, as I mentioned, is a curious device because it's front-mounted on the mother ship. Hmm. So there's a visualization. Try it out and see what it does for you. I don't know. I never said that before. Just like made it up, you know, as I'm speaking, you see. Of course, it's based on certain things that I'm drawing upon, you know.
Sure.
Creative mythologist makes things up, but rather in the way that a jazz musician makes things up, you know, in a jam session. If you listen to John Coltrane play My Favorite Things, well, it's totally improvised.
Mm-hmm.
He's making it up as he goes along. But My Favorite Things is a known tune, and he's faithful to the tune. So this is somewhat how I operate, and I offer this visualization of the mothership just for your enjoyment and to play with and to see what it brings up for you. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. So the center part of the joining parts of the two sides of the figure eight, then you tie that in with the barycenter as kind of a figurative visualization you could have. It's very nice.
Yeah. In fact, the Earth, when we want to visualize the Earth as a ship moving through space, we don't want to visualize it purely as a planet in three-dimensional space. We want to visualize it as a celestial body in four-dimensional space. That is, the dimension of time must be added.
Mm-hmm.
When you add the dimension of time, there are two visualizations you can use. One of them is that you see the orbital paths of the planets stretched into spirals.
Mm-hmm.
So, Thomas, what I'd like to do right now is to make a few corrections very quickly and then move into a couple of subjects that I've outlined here, if you don't mind.
Absolutely.
In the last talk I gave, which people are writing about, questioning me about on American Freedom Radio, at the very end of the talk, I used the term crypto-Satanist. And I think in the way that I used it, which was facetiously or by illusion, people might have thought that I was admitting that I am a crypto-Satanist. Okay? Well, I most certainly am not admitting that. And I most certainly don't have to admit it because I'm not. I'll tell you whatever I am, you can count on it, but that I'm not. Anyway, what I said was about the way that I operate is up front and out in the open. So if I were a crypto-Satanist, you wouldn't have to study my work for 20 years before it dawned on you that I am. You see what I mean?
Yes, certainly.
That's what besides, I don't look like a crypto-Satanist. I look a bit more like, you know, cross between Mifune and Deputy Dog. You know? A crypto-Satanist has a five-day shadow and very thin cheekbones, deep-set eyes, wears black leather, and talks in a very suave manner.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not obviously one of those. Okay?
Got it.
So, I'm not suave. So, the other thing I want to correct is regarding working with the Gaia mythos and the Sophianic mythos. I may have referred to the Andromeda story over time as the story of the fallen woman, but it's not. It's the myth of the chained woman. It's an important distinction. You might also know, and this is a second correction, that in the Sophia mythos, I have rendered her consort as Thelite.
Yes.
I believe that is the correct and helpful, instructive version that we can use in order to develop the story, rather than to claim that her consort or counterpart in engineering the genome was Christos. The Aeon Christos played a very vital role in the has an intimate relation to the human genome due to the Christic intercession.
Mm-hmm.
The Christic intercession. But on my best view and vision of things, Thelite should be considered as the counterpart to the divine Sophia. So we are the children of Sophia, wisdom, and Thelite, which is free will. Finally, I would add that when I originally wrote about the Gaia mythos, the Sophianic vision story on medhistory.org and on my book, I've often tried to correlate the story to astronomy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it is an astronomical myth, and it shall always be such. And this is how we're learning and developing and exploring it. But since I began to make the correlation between the myth and astronomy, I've come to understand that we have a new emergent paradigm in astronomy, and that would be the electric universe and plasma cosmology.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, I don't know much about that. I know far less than I would like to know. I'm brushing up on it. But I would like to tell those of the crew and other people who are following the Sophianic vision story that from now and in the future, disregard the old astronomy completely and use the new paradigm of electric universe and plasma cosmology. And through that, I am totally convinced that you're going to find beautiful and exact correlations. And that is the way to go with the astronomical myth from here on out. Okay?
Very good. So moving away from a gravity-based astronomy into a physics, into more of an electromagnetic and a plasmatic approach.
Absolutely. The first thing that we can begin to understand is that the spiral arms of the galaxy are not just rivers of dust floating in empty space. They are actually streams of electrically charged plasmatic currents twirling around the hub of the galactic center. When we see the mother ship, she's not floating on top of a surface. When you visualize the Earth as the mother ship, she's not floating on top of a surface as she sails along the galactic arms. She's actually in the arms. She's embedded. And so the glass bottom represents the fact that we can see down beneath the ship as well as up above it. Okay, is that clear?
It is. It almost brings to mind a submarine more than a boat, in a sense.
Yeah, you could use the image of a submarine. It's because we have to bear in mind that and this is a known fact, that the Earth, the planetary system, Earth and other planets in the sun, is embedded in the galactic arm. It's not floating along on top of the surface of the arm.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Okay, that's very useful. Very nice.
Finally, before we move into our topics here, I just want to say thanks to those people on the crew who have volunteered to help with certain projects. we have a beautiful version of the crew notes, just formatted with in PDF format with beautiful images and laid out in an elegant fashion. I just really love elegance. It's also laid out in such a way that it can be printed off and read in hard copy.
Mm.
It's really, what should I say? Well, it's important to me that this material be available in hard copy.
Mm-hmm.
And I encourage those on the crew who go to that site to print it off and to keep a hard copy version to pass it around. Beautiful. It looks really, really beautiful in the way that it's been done. Also, another crew member has set up a master page to all the audio files of my talks and interviews, with, of course, these Grok the Talk sessions at the top of the list.
Wonderful.
The third thing that is happening as we speak is that a couple of people have volunteered to compile instances of the Gayan Tantric Vow. And so I will send these over. When people send them in to me, I will send them to these two crew members, and they will compile a testimony of people who have taken the Gayan Tantric Vow, along with the language of the vow as an exemplary model of other people who want to make their vow. And there will also be some anecdotal comments on what happened to people when they took the vow, a little bit of commentary on the effects and things that happened. That's in the works. And finally, I want to thank you, Thomas, and everyone else who helped me to put together the Crop Circle Challenge and get that out on the surge of the 30th of August.
Well, indeed, that was one of the most amazing presentations I've ever heard in my life. I've listened to it 4 times now, and I'm blown away each time I do so. And I think we'll probably talk about that a little bit more in a couple of days here when we do our joint interview with Dr. Wood. So I'm sure we'll cover the crop circle connection in that talk as well.
Yes, we will. So that's my my thanks to the volunteers and collaborators. And my apologies to people who've written me at Navigator or at metahistory.org. If I haven't got back to you, I do answer personally all messages that come in, or almost all. I answer 19 out of 20. So I apologize if I haven't got back to you yet, but I've been kind of overwhelmed for the last month.
That's an understatement. And I had one question there is, how will people be able to access the crew notes that have been put into the PDF file format?
Right now, they're only accessible to the crew, and I send out the address and the password to crew members.
Okay? Wonderful.
And that's the way we'll leave it for the moment, but it won't always be that way. We're not doing anything secret or behind, you know, Thomas. I am totally in favor of total transparency and honesty.
Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing secret or mysterious about it. It's just a matter of sort of controlling and directing the material and setting guidelines. That's all. Setting boundaries.
Mm-hmm. Very good. That's completely understood. So are you ready to dive into things, John?
Sure. I'd like to talk today a little bit about myself, if I might.
Please.
It's a poignant subject, but it does come up now and then. I just wanted to say that, you know, Maine Turton comes from Maine. And do you know what the state motto of Maine is? If you happen to know, probably not. If you haven't lived in the States for so long.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, every state in the United States has its motto, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're from Montana, right?
Yeah, the big sky country.
Oh, well, that's great for being on the crew of the mothership. It's a great motto. Well, the motto of the state of Maine is a Latin word, actually. D-I-R-I-G-O. There I go. And what it means is, I lead. That's an interesting motto, because it's not my personal motto as a Turton, because I don't want to be a leader as such, you know. I don't like leaders, you know. And yet, at the same time, the nature of the work of a Tertön is to discover treasure teachings or termas. And these treasure teachings, insofar as they are genuine sacred instructions from the sphere of the Dakinis, have enormous directive power. I think I've pointed out before that what I'm putting out is different from what other people are putting out on the internet these days. I'm not putting out information. There's plenty of information if you want to go find it out there. I'm putting out instruction. And one of the differences between the two is that you can just listen to information and you can take it or leave it. For instance, you could go and listen to the Red Ice interviews and pick six of them out of the list there. Henrik does many fine interviews on a variety of subjects with many different people.
Mm-hmm.
But these interviews that you would here on Red Ice and elsewhere is almost entirely information. And so after you hear them, you can take it or leave it. You can't take or leave what I talk about. You take it or it leaves you. See, that's different.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take it, if you take the instruction, which is coming from the Tertön, or through the Tertön, rather, from the Dakini realms, then you must apply that instruction. You must integrate it. It must become body knowledge. It must become ethical, magical, existential, moral, psychosomatic. It is like D.H. Lawrence would say, blood knowledge.
Blood knowledge.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah. It gets right into your blood. Especially if they give you the heart drop experience. It gets right into your blood. Dakini knowledge is an elixir in the blood. I know because I have this elixir in my blood. And it is actually physically an elixir. It's like a liquid crystal that runs in your veins. And it comes off the tip of Kali's knife when she stabs you. This is the Kalika initiation. So, the Tertön imparts sacred instruction, and this isn't just information that you sit back, blah, 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 here's another person talking, and then you say, that was interesting, that was not interesting. You take it, or it leaves you. And if it leaves you, then don't listen. It's not for you. But if you can take it on board, you're going to realize, and I know that people do because they write me more and more, affirming this to be the case, you're going to take it on board immediately and you're going to integrate it and it's going to work. It's going to be an active part of your life, as happens with the vow. The moment you take the vow, it's instantaneously effective. The moment you start doing Dakini practices with the lunar cycles, it's instantaneously effective because it is sacred instruction. It's not just information to be mulled around in your head. So I want to make that point clear, because I've been reflecting a lot lately at this juncture in my life about my mission and role as a Tertön.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, writing a long piece about it for MetaHistory.org. I hope to get it up in the next few days. It's called Treasure Teaching.
Very good. And yeah, a lot of the mails that I get from people, those would be the key words that seem to pop up from people when they're, especially when they're writing the first time, explaining how they felt coming across Planetary Tantra. It is engrossing. It grabs a hold of them, and spontaneous. Those seem to be kind of the key words that are embedded in their communications.
Indeed. So I want you all to know that my role as a Tertön, there I go. I'm the kid from Maine, you know. I lead. But why do I lead? I don't lead you with my ego. I don't lead you with my arrogance. As I said, I'm not leading by my arrogance or my ego. I'm not leading by the force of my personality, or I'm not leading by the imposition of some massive cosmic solution that I've cooked up. I lead by the instruction from the wisdom sphere of the Dakinis, which is also what leads me. So we are all led by in the same way. Some years ago, I wrote a poem, quite a few years ago, in which I used this word, dirigo. I lead. And I used it to describe the sight of the boats in Friendship Harbor. You know, mm-hmm. grew up in a fishing village in Maine called Friendship. And I didn't realize it at the time when I wrote this poem. It was quite a long time ago. I think it was about 38, 40 when I wrote it, how much it referred to my life as a Turton, because at that time I didn't formally define myself as such. But anyway, if I might, could I just read you these lines and you'll get the point I'm making better from the poetry.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm all ears.
It's a poem about what happened to me in India. So it starts out with a reference to being in India, and then it goes into Friendship. 2 months into the South, wandering without aim, no destination and no one to blame, but humanity deserves some great correction. While across the harbor at Friendship, all the boats lie on separate moorings. First light, the sun touches the dire ledges of down east. Here I go. Each one, a neat wedge with aquiline prow, cleaves its proud and solitary gaze toward the unseen trough of the southwest breeze funneling down Muscongus Bay. Each cabin, no more than a mendicant's hut. The mast pole with the halyard tapping monotonous Morse across the mauve gray waters. And each prow of each boat harrows down in the prevailing wind that sets all the boats on separate moorings, heading exactly in the same direction. There I go. But where do I lead? And who must be going there, so alone and so absorbed in a native strangeness bent on some great correction? So this poem, with this image of all the boats in Friendship Harbor, and how many times I saw this, Friendship Harbor is a deep estuary in Muscongus Bay, and the wind comes from the southeast or the southwest. And all the boats are out there on their separate moorings. Everyone is an independent boat, just like every one of us is an independent mind and heart and soul.
Mm-hmm.
And they all point in the same direction.
Mm.
And this is how it is with the Sophia myth. We are all independent vessels, but we're all sailing in the same direction. When we live with inside that myth is the supreme directive power. The story directs you.
Mm-hmm.
Story directs you. And that story is able to take hold in the imagination of each one of us and direct us as individuals toward the common aim of humanity. That is why that story is so unique. So I'd like to talk now just a little bit, Thomas, about my aims for the coming months till the end of the year.
Sure. Can I ask you how old you are when you wrote that?
I think I was about 39, and I was about 19 when I was in India. So I was describing my experiences in the south of India, wandering alone without aim, bent on some great correction. I had no idea what that correction was.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? You have the theme of aim, of correction, and then the overall nautical image in there that's all come together, you know, some 20 years after that. That's fascinating.
Yeah, I was about 38 when I wrote that poem. Yeah.
Very interesting. So it was brewing inside there for some reason from that far back.
That's the nature of the human imagination, I'm telling you. What a power we have been given by the wisdom goddess here. Let's use it correctly.
Absolutely.
As I said, if you don't use your imagination, someone else will. But the key is, use it correctly. Use the sane. Use the real and not the fantastic imagination.
Mm-hmm.
The real and true imagination is the one that integrates to her story. Everything else is narcissistic fantasy and deviance.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm beginning to understand that very clearly. Yes, indeed.
Good.
Now, you want to talk about your aims for the rest of the year here?
To the end of the year.
Okay.
I have basically the aim to chart the course ahead in our wonderful nautical metaphor. And as you know, Thomas, I've said this often, I don't predict and I don't use predictive grammar or syntax when I speak.
Mm-hmm.
Very careful of using the future tense. So I could explain why that is in some other occasion. But the role of the navigator is not to predict what will happen to the mothership on the journey, because no one can predict that. Storms can come up. She may decide to stop in at a port, or she may decide to pass a port and not go to harbor there. The journey cannot be predicted, but I can chart the course of the journey, and I want to do that for everyone by the end of this year, so that you have it in notes, so that you can see the course of the journey all the way to March 2014.
Very good.
Right. Correction takes 3 years, mm-hmm. from March 11th to March 2014. And technically, correction occurs in the length of time it takes from Jupiter to move through its own perihelion, which is 15 degrees of Aries, to its north node, which is 10 degrees of Cancer. So when Jupiter moves that distance through the fishes, the ram, the bull, and into the twins, in the same sequence, the apogee of the moon advances to the head of the twins. And when it passes the head of the twins and enters the constellation of the crab, correction is complete. Correction only takes 3 years. I've said this often, but I think I need to clarify something here regarding this statement.
Mm-hmm.
I'm referring to setting the initial conditions of correction. Correction continues to proceed after March 2014. It continues until the very end of Kali Yuga, which is another 200 years. Kali Yuga ends in 2216 AD, which is also the end of the great processional cycle of 25,920 years.
Hmm.
So correction for humanity and for the planet continues in the next two centuries. But the initial conditions of correction, and this is so wonderful to know, it's so fantastic that I can tell you this. The initial conditions of correction are established in 10 seconds of her time, which is 3 years or 1,080 days of human time. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Got it.
Now, I've given you some idea of how I'm going to plot correction and how I do it. I gave you the concepts to work with, which are simple and elementary. I'm sure you can all take them on board and use them in many ways. You have divine memory and you have divine alchemy.
Mm-hmm.
We live between divine memory and divine alchemy. The mission of the Anthropos, the fulfillment of the anthropic strain on Earth, our particular strain. There are many others living on planetary systems in this galaxy. But our particular strain realizes itself. We come into the fulfillment and beauty and strength of the Anthropos between divine alchemy and divine memory. If you can work those two processes with the goddess, the god it made, that is the sum and essence of the process.
And divine memory takes place through the apogee. In the fishes and perigee, or alchemy takes place in the perigee.
That's right.
In the virgin, yes.
That's right. I trace the recapitulations of the wisdom goddess through the movement of the apogee of the moon, which is now in the fishes, It moves into the RAM in January of 2012, and it goes before the satanic face of Cetus, which is where Jupiter is currently located. You see, Jupiter, the tugboat of the system, is parked in front of the satanic face of Cetus. Why is it parked there? Because it's pulling the Earth around to a correction, and it's bringing the Earth around into a motion whereby, kind of a slingshot motion, It will tow the Earth into the position, and then the Earth will propel itself past the satanic face of Cetus, which is marked by the five stars at the head of that constellation. And that it will do in January, February, March of 2012. So we've got plenty of time to prepare on board for this. I'm going to do the best I can. I am doing the best I can. See, don't want to use future tense. I am doing the best I can to chart that course for all of you. And it's my great pleasure and privilege to do that. Now, the other thing I'm doing is more difficult in a way, and that is charting the perigee surges. I haven't written about them yet. It's coming up. I just want to say that the perigee surges are the indications of divine alchemy. They occur more or less opposite to the apogee, but not exactly, and they're a much more complicated pattern because they go backward and forward. You might recall that I said that in April 17th, the first time there was a perigee surge after correction was right in the center of the upper chest of the Virgin.
Yes.
And I indicated that that was a thymus hit.
Mm-hmm.
By which I mean that the wisdom goddess is, purely through her intention — you ask how she does this, folks — she just intends it. All she has to do is intend, and things happen. It's as if you could look at your finger, if you could hold out your hand, and you could intend your hand to turn blue. Well, that would be a magical act. It's not impossible that you could do that, you know. Mm-hmm. This is how an Aeon operates. She just operates by intention. And she has turned her intention to us in correction. And in April, she hit us with a massive jolt in the thymus because she's boosting the immunity of the species. She's boosting our immunity because we need to have a very, very high immunity level by January, February, March of 2012, because at that time, the moment comes for humanity to look at the actual naked face of evil.
Hmm.
The naked face of that which threatens and destroys, presents the risk of destroying the divine experiment. We have the opportunity to look it right in the face. But looking it in the face is somewhat like taking a blast of toxic air.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to have very high immunity against that threat in order to face that threat.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you, the tracing of the perigee surges is absolutely astonishing, because she's not only giving us one hit in April, give us another one coming up soon, September 28th, and then there's a third immunity hit on February 11th, 2012. It is so important that we have this psychic, moral, and spiritual, emotional, mental immunity to what we're facing, that she's actually delivering three successive jolts to that area.
Wow. Three booster shots, in a sense.
Yeah, booster shots. Exactly. Thank you for that analogy. And the next booster shot's coming up this month on September 28th. Okay? So it's absolutely amazing. So I'm going to chart this for you. I'm going to chart both the apogee and perigee patterns, and then you yourself can follow them, because you are the highest authority on this experiment for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I just have the visionary skills and the talent to chart it, but I can't tell anyone how to experience it, obviously, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And through your own experience, you will learn, you can learn many, many, many things, and realize that all this talk about interactivity with the wisdom goddess is absolutely and totally real.
Yep, real and verifiable, exactly.
Real and verifiable. So I just want to say that coming up also in the perigee searches, I'll give you a little clue because I know some people are asking about this. You have this question in the back of your minds. Through the month of late October to November and December and right up into January, the hits in the of the perigee indicate that that is the moment when I can disclose right action. Now, I have right action. It's ready to go. People are wondering why I don't put it out. Well, there's some very serious considerations here, my friend.
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you, this is not something to look at lightly.
Mm-hmm.
And it's coming. It is on the way, and it's ready. And I just want to point out that I will follow the timing of the perigee surges from late October through November 23rd, December 22nd, and January 17th on those particular three surges to release the right action material. Now, right action was kind of intimated or hinted already on MetaHistory.org, as some of you may know. Okay? Just want to give you a clear picture. And it's like, to use a crude analogy, a double-barrel shotgun for predators.
Hmm.
This weapon has two barrels.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is the existential aspect of right action, which anyone can practice. The existential version of right action is very similar to the Freeman movement. You know what that is?
You're talking about the legalistic approach?
Exactly, Freeman.
Sure.
Freeman movement.
Robert Menard, yeah.
Yeah, there's a number of people on the internet. If you go on YouTube and put in Freeman, you get these wonderful clips about these people who are standing up to authority.
Mm-hmm.
The key to the Freeman movement is that they have shown that we are, again, being tricked, that the game is rigged. But as a matter of fact, when you go into a legal situation in a courtroom, you don't owe them any allegiance at all. They have no authority over you, but they trick you. Because they trick you into making an agreement with them and contracting with them, as it were. That's the term.
Mm-hmm.
And only when you contract with them can they hold you liable and responsible to the rules of the contract. But there's nothing that says you have to contract with them.
Yeah.
You see? And so the freedom movement is a wonderful movement, which is growing, I think, very big, and is going to be used by people to stand up to authority and to say, I don't buy your rules, and I don't play by your rules, and I am a sovereign individual, and I am not subject to your rigged game. So one part, one of the barrels of right action, is very compatible and similar to the Freeman movement. But I would say that it represents the same type of activity, but on the offensive.
Mm-hmm.
It represents an offensive form of the Freeman movement. In my understanding of the Freeman movement, a lot of it is defensive. That is to say, if the law comes for you, or if you're called to court, you go there and you defend yourself against the lies and manipulations and depredations of the corporate legal system, which is trying to con you and screw you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's defensive. And again, in a sense, you could say it's an immunological response, harking back to that metaphor. Through the sovereignty that we realize in the Freeman movement, we become immune to the depredations and intimidation and extortion of the corporate legal system. But that's all defensive. There's also an offensive use of sovereign rights. And that is what one aspect of right action to be explained in the coming months.
So one barrel of this double barrel approach is kind of taking the Freeman approach and putting on an offensive
exactly.
Terminology.
Yeah.
Now, is that already prepared, and that will be coming out during the perigee surges, or is that something you have to write from here on out?
It's being prepared right now under instruction from Shodashi.
Okay.
And I want to say more about, just in a bit, about who Shodashi is.
Right.
Getting back to the shift question.
Okay. And what's the other barrel?
The second barrel of this predator hunting shotgun is ritual. And this is not for everyone, and many people don't have the guts for this one because it's about lethal magic. So that is also ready to go in the coming months. It's my aim to bring that forth for your consideration. Okay?
Very good.
Now, I'd just like to say one more thing about the perigee surges. I'll do that in the timing of the perigee surges, all of that.
Okay.
Why does right action come to be revealed in the timing of the perigee surges? Let me answer my own question in two ways. First of all, I really want crew members and all those other wonderful people who are listening to my talks more and more consistently to understand just exactly what I do. That is what you can do as well. What I'm doing is I'm demonstrating something to you. The way that I have, it's so new and so dynamic and powerful that I had to coin a word for it some time ago. And so I coined this word, actional, A-C-T-I-O-N-A-L. As you know, Thomas, Joseph Campbell proposed in his book Creative Mythology that there would be a new kind of mythology in the 21st century.
Right.
He called it creative mythology. I call it directive or applied mythology. What is creative mythology? Well, Joseph Campbell saw it, but he didn't himself realize it. He didn't himself practice it. He didn't have the fantastic opportunity that I have now to get together with a group of people, a team, a crew, and practice and explore this together. Creative mythology, as he intended it, was very simple. It was like saying, get your ass out of the academic armchair. It's not about information. It's not about taking on board tons and tons of information about ancient myth and reading about the Egyptian gods and reading about the Greek gods and just stuffing our minds with all this information. No, it's about putting myth into practice, using it directively, and using it actionally. So what I'm doing is I'm using it actionally, and I'm showing you how to do this at the same time. For instance, a really simple example is the crop circle interview. The crop circle talk, rather, the challenge to the crop circle wizards.
Mm-hmm.
I contacted you and several other people on the mothership crew saying that I wanted to get this out on the 30th of September. And then I recorded it, and in the meantime, you were collecting addresses to send it to, so that at the moment that it was done, I sent out the MP3 file, and you activated this talk on a number of places on the internet. And the timing of that was timed to the last perigee surge, which was in 6 degrees of Libra. That's actional. What I'm actually doing is I'm taking the moment and the message and putting them together into an action that goes out at that moment. That is ritualized action. That is creative mythology in action. And anyone can do that. Anyone can learn this. It's not difficult to learn, and it's a lot of fun to do. And the efficacy, you might ask me, well, does it work? Well, we'll see about that, won't we? I mean, this is an experiment. Let's not be arrogant here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even Romic aeons don't know how things work out.
Mm-hmm. Well, if the initial stages of it are any indication, it's definitely spreading at a very high speed, much faster than I would have imagined it could, yeah.
Yeah, you said there's more than 1,000 downloads just from Grok.
Yeah, and that's only in 2 days, yeah.
Well, you see, initial conditions are the key. Magic works by initial conditions. Correction works by initial conditions.
Mm-hmm.
When you do a cording, you're setting the initial conditions. And the moment that you cut that cord, after you've put your intention into the tension of the tree yantra, you cut that cord and your intention is read by Gaia through the tension, and it becomes immediately actional depending on the initial conditions. That's why we take such great care with the initial conditions. Magic works depending on the beauty and precision of the initial conditions.
Hmm.
So you could say, in a sense, that sending out this crop circle talk a couple of days ago was an act of magic, or an act of mythology made actional.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I do. And it's possible, I want to say, to live this way all the time. All the time. Mm. It's possible to have a ritual way of life that engages the divine wisdom goddess with human intention all the time in everything we do. And I would not be surprised if the Gaian-oriented communities of the future, the ones that are going to emerge out of the breakdown of the current system, don't have this kind of practice as part of their way of life. I would be surprised because it's there. It's being, you know, I'm showing how to do it. And all indigenous communities have a ritual aspect, don't they, Thomas?
Indeed they do.
Yeah.
There now, John, I don't want to sidetrack you at all, but I did want to just interject one question there. Does Shodashi have any kind of a tie-in to, like, the ritualistic nature of humanity? Is that something you've picked up on?
Shodashi is a name. It means Sweet 16, by the way.
Huh.
It's a name for one of the Mahavidyas of the Shakti cluster. She's also called Sundari, which is a Sanskrit word for beautiful, or Tripura Sundari, the most beautiful of the three domains. So, Shodashi could be the Shakti of the current shift, which began on Tuesday. You know, we've got a lot on our plate right now, Thomas, because so many things are happening. First of all, we're in the first 2 seconds of correction.
Uh-huh.
It just happens, you know, you probably noticed that the perigee and apogee surges fall sometimes quite close to the new and full moons.
Yes.
And so, you know, we've got a lot on our plate. It's a lot to sort out, and no one can stay on top of it, believe me. So people who are listening to me sometimes feel that you're not staying on top of this and current with it. Don't worry about it. Just take and handle it.
Uh-huh.
I can't do it myself. You know?
Uh-huh.
But I am able, because I have a long practice with transception, which is clairaudient audition of the Shakti frequencies, I can, you know, maybe catch things that other people don't. So I want to say this about the current shift. I think there is a very strong carryover from the Bhairavi shift, not only into this current shift, not exactly a double shift. I think that what happened was that in the last Bhairavi shift, that is to say, roughly the month of August 2011, came to a turning point with humanity. Turning point in our own humanity. And that is a turning point toward the sense of responsibility for holding and expressing sacred anger.
I like that.
Bhairavi is sacred anger. Now, the feeling of anger is tremendously important. A lot of you have read my book, Not in His Image, and you like it. You find it powerful. Well, thank you very much, and I'm here to tell you that every single sentence of that book was written at a peak of white-hot anger. And when people write me and say it's the most liberating thing I've ever read, I'm not surprised, because a samurai blade can be very liberating.
Sure can.
And so sacred anger is now our responsibility in correction. You want to stay on board with correction, then get in touch with the transpersonal sacred anger that you carry. There's a lot to be angry about. And to master that anger so that it doesn't turn upon yourself and destroy you and eat you up is part of the warrior's path, which is led by Bhakti. Because she is also a manifestation of Durga, who is the invincible. And that is another name for Kali. So the warrior call went out last month, Thomas. The warrior call went out to everyone on this planet. And I think the Bhairavi shift ended a few days ago.
I'm getting the same feeling, yeah.
But there's an ongoing resonance, that is to say, folks, the call is still out there, and you had better size yourself up real fast in the next 3 months. Okay?
Okay, got it.
You up for that call?
Ready to go.
Some people can't handle anger, and that's okay. There are other missions and other tasks. They can't handle anger. But I'll tell you one thing. The story that anger towards something destroys you, that you can't overcome obstacles or destructive things by anger, is an absolute lie, and it's another one of the cons of the perpetrators. The thing with anger is, can you handle it or not? It's like a samurai sword. Don't cut yourself with it.
Yeah.
Don't harm innocent people. Know how to use it. Mm-hmm. And so the Bhairavi call to sacred anger is still resonating across the planet. The omens would indicate to me, though, that we are in the Shodashi shift. And I want to say this about Shodashi right now, just as a note for you to contemplate. Shodashi is very much connected with beauty. But the concept, and of course, Gaia is all about beauty. And I often say this. I sometimes wonder if I put people off because, you know, one of the things about being human is that, you know, maybe you don't feel beautiful, you know. And how do you react to the first instruction of the Diamond Sky Dakinis, the first line of the term of Gaia Awakening? You cannot become anything but more beautiful. Now, how do you react to that? You know, it's a very high teaching. But we have such a perverted sense of beauty in our world. We are taught to be beautiful in ways that are not beautiful. We are given models of beauty that are completely false and sick. So I would like to introduce to your mind today part of the instruction of Shodashi that I am currently transceiving. Beauty is a bird of prey. Beauty is a bird of prey.
Like an eagle or a hawk or a falcon.
That's right. Prey. And the parts of beauty, the elements of beauty are many. And it is the role of the warrior and the lover alike, and those who are devoted to the supreme innocence of humanity and to the wonder and magic of Sophia, to understand the many elements of beauty. From the instruction of Shodashi, I give you these two elements: truth and freedom. See, truth is many things, but one thing it is supremely, and that is, it's really, really beautiful. Remember what Keats said? Keats, that romantic poet, he said it well, you know. Beauty is truth, and truth beauty, that is all you know on earth and all you need to know. So one component of beauty is truth. But what is just as beautiful as truth in your eyes? You as a human being, look out on the world. Look out on this planet. Look at society. Look at the way other people behave. What is just as beautiful as truth? Freedom. Freedom is really, really beautiful. And so these are our concepts of beauty to take on board, that what I would call the factors of moral beauty, or the moral components of beauty. Now I have here in front of me, we just have about 10 minutes left, I think, a wonderful book by a woman mythologist named Jane Ellen Harrison. I don't have very many rare books in my library, but this is one. Cambridge University Press, 1912. Themis, T-H-E-M-I-S, by Jane Ellen Harrison. Very fantastic and important mythologist of the early 20th century. And a lot of this book is about the aspect of the ancient world which was called in Greek Dike, D-I-K-E. Dike was understood by the ancient Greeks as to mean the moral order of the universe, the moral order of nature. Because ancient pagan people and indigenous people see morality in nature. It's only the predators who deny there is morality in nature, and it's only the materialists and the people whose imagination has died who look at nature as having no morality. I intend to show in my presentation of Right Action exactly what Gaian ethics is. The basis of it is the prey-predator bond.
Mm-hmm.
Not to be confused with the victim-perpetrator bond.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The prey-predator bond is part of Gaia's symbiosis. When a hawk floating in the valley above my house dives down and gets a field mouse, that's the prey-predator bond, and it's a symbiosis. See, my friends, Gaia put us into a world where there is a prey-predator dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there may be other planetary systems where other strains of humanity live that don't have this dynamic. And there may be other planetary systems in this galaxy with humans living on them, surrounded by other animals who don't eat and kill each other. And if you want to go there, well, then go find it if you don't like it here.
Mm-hmm.
But the brutal truth and the beautiful truth is that here creatures kill and eat each other. And that is part of Gaia's ethics. And if we don't understand it, we'll never, ever be able to face predators in our own midst.
Very interesting. Yeah, the prey-predator relationship is a completely healthy, natural, normal, integral part of life on Earth. Yeah.
It is, and it's beautiful. It's beautiful to see these kills. It's beautiful to see the kill of a cheetah
mm-hmm.
with a gazelle. It's not ugly. It's not like a mafia kill, is it?
No.
No. See the difference?
Yeah.
So there's a lot to be said about this, a lot to be taught. It's my highest desire right now. The highest desire of my entire life is to deliver Right Action, impeccable and intact, and as lucid as the day is long. And I have, as for my instruction to do that, for my tutelary deity, my tutor, Vishodashi. Let me read you this passage from page 527 of this book by Jane Ellen Harrison.
Okay.
Dike. Okay? Closely analogous to Dike is Antarita, R-I-T-A, which is the Sanskrit word for cosmic order, is the Chinese Tao, only it seems less moralized and more magical. Tao is like Dike, the way of nature. And man's whole religion, his whole moral effort, is to bring himself into accordance with Tao. By so doing, he becomes a microcosm, and by sympathetic magic can control the world. The calendar not only indicates natural facts, but prescribes moral doings. Tao, like Rita and Dike, is potent in all three spheres, in outside nature, in the relation of man to his gods, and in the relation of man to man, or morality proper. But Tao, unlike Rita and Dike, does not seem to include intellectual truth. So, this is written in a language of over 100 years old, and it contains some paternalistic language, but I think you get the point.
Mm-hmm.
She has this most beautiful statement about Dike. This I would have you write down and put on your fridge. Dike, who was the way of the world, became in Orphic Hand's Vengeance, with a capital V. Vengeance on the wrongdoer, on anyone who overstepped or violated the way. So, Chodashi, who teaches aesthetics and beauty, can read about this Mahavidyan several places on metahistory.org. He's really going to be now our tutor in the morality of right action and in the prey-predator symbiosis for our own species, so that we can learn how to take down the predators in our own midst, in the same way that a predator in nature takes down its prey. They are our prey. You see, it's all backwards.
It's backwards, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. They are the prey of the luminous child.
Yeah.
And if I have my way, not too long from now, a 14 or a 16 or 20-year-old kid will be able to take down an interspecies predator using right action. Just imagine that kind of society, folks.
Yep.
So that's the direction we're going in. That's the direction I lead, says the main Turton, you know, dear I go. But I'm only leading as I'm being led, and I call upon your patience and your compassion to understand that and not take me for a control freak.
yeah, don't worry about that.
Thank you, that's very
Now, I just, one thing I didn't really hear properly, I think, for the connection. You said in Orphic hands?
Yeah, in Orphic terms.
Okay, what do you mean by Orphic?
The Orphic cult of ancient Greece understood that Dike was vengeance. Okay? They understood the Orphic, Harrison is saying, that Dike was known all through the ancient world. She was the goddess of morality and social order in ancient Greek civilization, D-I-K-E.
Mm-hmm.
But what Harrison was saying is the Orphics had a particular spin on Dike. You know, it's from the Orphics that we get the saying, a kid that has fallen into milk, you know. So the Orphics were a cult who actually encountered, a mystery cult who actually encountered the organic light. From that same group of ancient illuminated shamans, we have this vital bit of information that Dike teaches vengeance with a capital V. So it's not V for victory, my folks. It's V for vengeance.
V for vengeance. Very nice.
V for vengeance. That's right. Dike is vengeance.
So you're saying... Mm-hmm. So the right action instructions are going to be coming out more in alignment with the perigee surges.
I'm doing it actionally. You know now what that means.
Yes.
I match moment and the message,
uh-huh.
and I release it actionally at that moment. It becomes action at that moment. The message, the instruction becomes action at the moment indicated by the cosmos itself. This is what I'm doing.
Very nice. Now, John, is there anything else you want to add on to what you see mapped out, in a sense, for the rest of the year?
No, I just want to say this one thing, that since I wrote Narnia's Image, I was always a very angry guy in my life. I never took out my anger on other people. I had to kick cans and, you know, kick tree stumps and stuff like this. If I take it out on somebody, they will have a memorable experience for sure. But I just want to say that since I wrote Not in His Image, I got a lot of anger out of my system. And now I don't carry my anger on me so much anymore. It rides a mule.
Okay.
Yeah. Kind of, my mule kicks.
It kicks, huh?
Yeah.
So your anger is a little bit separate from you, but it does rear up its hind legs once in a while, huh?
It does indeed, yeah.
Well, very good. Well, that was all fascinating, and it's as fresh for me as for everyone else, because I didn't know where we were going today, but that was absolutely a wonderful short journey there, John.
Good. Well, wonderful as always to be with you, and the next session will be number 16, which will end the first volume of our talk together.
Very nice. We'll
begin. Good.
Okay. All right, John. All right. Well, let's close it down there for today, and we'll figure out when to do the next talk sometime next week.
Sure enough. Thank you.